Hey there, it's Kaysunga, and I have a really cool announcement for y'all. Headspace is now offering mental health coaching in the Headspace app. You can connect with a trained expert for live, text-based one-on-one support on your time from anywhere. Whether they're helping you cope with daily stress and anxiety or supporting you through big life events like loss or relationship hurdles, your coach will draw from clinically validated tools to help you reach any mental health goals. You can text a mental health coach for just $99.99 a month. Just sign up on the Headspace app or at headspace.com/coaching.
On a cold night in early February 2007, Chris Williams and his family were out driving. Chris was with his wife, Michelle, who was pregnant with their fifth child. Their daughter, Anna, and sons, Sam and Ben, were in the back seat. Their oldest son was out with some friends, but Chris and Michelle were taking the younger ones out for a treat. The family was on their way home from the ice cream parlor.
We were journeying on a stretch of road in Salt Lake City, Utah, that goes underneath a freeway. And so as we started to kind of go over the crown of the first section of the road and descend into the underpass area, I saw a pair of headlights coming at me at freeway speeds. It's a 30 mile an hour zone, and the car was going exceptionally fast. So fast that, I couldn't mentally process what to do. And we were T-boned.
The family sedan had been hit by a Jeep. The impact was immediate and devastating.
In that crash, my wife, who was in the passenger seat, she was killed instantly. I saw her just almost curled up as if she had fallen asleep in the passenger seat of the car. And then in the back seat were three of my children, my son Benjamin, who was almost 12 at the time. He was killed immediately. And my daughter Anna, who was seated in the middle of the back seat, was also killed immediately. And my six-year-old son, Sam, who was seated directly behind me, survived, although he was quite critically injured. In that crash, in that instant, as I look back upon it, it's just absolutely surreal to think about that. It's part of my memory. It's part of my history. But I think what happened next was, as I remember it, very human, and that is that I wanted to die as well. I remember putting my head back against the headrest and just trying to kind of will my soul out of my body, knowing that my wife was gone and at least two of my children had gone as well. It was probably the most soul-compressing grief that I've ever experienced in my life. And it was horrifying to go through that experience. But as I was passing through that grief, that just that unreal or surreal experience of being presented with this scene of just being with my family, going off to get a treat, and then just in the blink of an eye now processing that my wife and at least two of my children are gone. In the middle of that grief, I heard a voice. It was a voice that was presented to my mind as if somebody were speaking to me. And the voice said, "Let it go."
From Headspace Studios, I'm Catherine Schwarzenegger-Pratt. This is The Gift of Forgiveness, a podcast filled with inspiring stories from those who've overcome the unforgivable. On this show, we're talking with people about some very difficult situations they've been faced with in life and the many opportunities to practice forgiveness. We've had really open and honest conversations with each guest about their pains, struggles, and getting to where they are today. At some points, you as listeners might feel uncomfortable or anxious by people's discussions about forgiveness, and that's okay. That's the nature of forgiveness. It's a raw and complicated experience that is unique to each of us. If you have moments of feeling overwhelmed or very emotional, or just want to take a chance to reflect on something you just heard, I encourage you to be mindful of your feelings, to pause, take a beat, and take some deep breaths. Chris Williams' story is the first one from my book. I knew that it had to be included on this podcast because the circumstances are just so extraordinary. The moment Chris's family was killed, he heard this voice telling him to let it go and to forgive the person who hit them. He didn't know it until a little while later, but the driver was a 17-year-old named Cameron White.
Hello. This is Cameron.
Oh my goodness. Can't believe it. I appreciate you going and doing this, even though it's not necessarily the most pleasant or fun conversation. I want to go back to the beginning of your journey. And can you talk a little bit about just that evening and what happened?
I remember going to school. I was at Skyline High School in Utah and was planning on hanging out with my buddies later on that night. So I just went home. My buddies wanted to go to the Skyline basketball game. There was a basketball game that night. And I didn't really want to go, so I just told them, you know what, I'll see if I can get some alcohol tonight so we can kind of, you know, party. And you guys just let me know when the game's over and we'll meet up, you know, late at night. And I'm just waiting for the Skyline game to end. And then I, you know, I get the call. So I get in my Jeep and I drive over there. It's about probably a 10-15 minute drive over there. And I get there and I, you know, I feel fine. I don't feel like I was drunk. I mean, I felt tipsy, but I didn't feel like I was totally impaired. And the next thing I know, I'm just standing up. And I'm looking over at my overturned Jeep. It's upside down. I had no idea what just happened. I thought I had, you know, hit a barricade or something. My first reaction was just flight. And so I walked away and, you know, I thought, you know, let's just figure out, you know, get a buddy to come pick me up and I'll figure out how to do this. I was just thinking my parents are going to kill me. And I was, you know, when I drank and sometimes when I wasn't drinking, I was just extremely depressed. And I thought, you know what, rather than worry about this and deal with this with my parents and just have the repercussions, I just like, okay, you know, like, it's just time to end it. And so I ended up finding, I didn't have a knife, which I usually had with me, but there was just a chain link fence, a sharp chain link fence. And I remember slitting my wrists on it. And I, you know, I was bleeding quite a bit. And so I thought, okay, that's, you know, that's probably enough. And I ended up just walking away from there and just thinking, all right, I guess I'll just, you know, fall down somewhere and die.
Around the same time, someone came upon the accident and called 911. As Cameron staggered away from his overturned car, Chris was still trapped in his car waiting for help to arrive.
The transformation happened almost immediately. As I looked back upon my wife, I didn't see the trauma that she had sustained. I could see my son, and he looked just as if he was asleep in the back seat of the car, very, very peaceful. And I looked at my daughter, and I just felt her presence. It was an amazing experience to have that be my opportunity to say goodbye for now to my wife and the baby she was carrying and two of my four children. It may sound odd to some, but I just, in many ways, that voice, whoever it was or whatever, wherever that came from, it allowed me to kind of stop for a minute in the midst of all that grief and to realize that I had a decision to make right then and there. And as I sat in the car, what was going to be my path forward? And what I realized as I sat in the car that the only thing I could control was that what happened up in my mind. I couldn't control my healing or my pain or the situation that I was surrounded and presented with. And so my decision to let it go as I sat in the car was a conscientious decision that going forward, I would only focus on those things that I had full control over. And everything else that I didn't have in my control, I had to let it go.
Meanwhile, Cameron, the teenager who was driving under the influence, was in a daze.
I remember hearing sirens and, you know, it's kind of out in the distance and thinking, all right, that's probably for me. And so I just keep on walking and
eventually I, you know, there, the street that I was on was, had trees, just mature trees that are lining up on the street. And so I remember looking at these trees vividly. I remember looking at these trees and it's red and blue lights, you know, and I know a cop's coming down the street. Next thing I know, there are, you know, three or four cop cars there, guns drawn. And then I'm on my back and, or on my face and, knee in my back. They put me in an ambulance, took a, you know, a sample, blood alcohol sample. And I remember telling them that I couldn't, you know, I was too drunk to do any sobriety testing, which is what they wanted to do. So they ended up taking me to the public safety building in Salt Lake City, in the back of a cruiser. And I was just bloody. I mean, my knee was bloody. My I was bleeding from my head and my wrists. And I was just, you know, bloody everywhere. They ended up taking all of my clothes as evidence. I don't think I had anything besides my belt when I was finally released. But they took me to a public safety building. They took my fingerprints and they, you know, did the whole mugshot thing where you hold the placard. It was just surreal, you know, like you see in the movies. And they took me into this small room. It had to have been, you know, 8 feet by 8 feet with this tiny little table in the middle of the room with two chairs on one side and one chair on the other side. And they put me on the side facing the door. And I remember just sitting down and thinking, you know, what's going on here?
Chris and his surviving son were rushed to the hospital and treated for their injuries. It was there that Chris learned it was a 17-year-old drunk driver who had hit his car.
The first thing that came to my mind was an expression of concern. I was so concerned, even though I was physically just in pain, severe pain. My lungs actually were filling up with liquid from the injury I had sustained. I felt I was starting to drown. Even in the midst of that, it was almost a separation from the physical pain I had and my mental thoughts and my concerns. And they were for that young man. I wanted him to be not hurt. I wanted him to not be in pain and not suffering. I then asked for the community to pray for that young man. I earnestly and anxiously wanted that young man to be okay.
For the moment, Cameron was okay. The police took him to a juvenile detention hall.
At this point, I still had no idea, like, how, you know, the seriousness of the situation. I was just a punk kid. This guy enters the door, mustache, glasses, and says, do you know what happened tonight? And I said, nope. He says, do you want to talk about what happened tonight? And I said, nope. And then he says, do you want me to tell you what happened tonight? And I said, sure. And then he told me that I caused an accident that a pregnant mother and two children died in the accident that I caused. And because I caused it, I was going to go to prison for life.
When you found out that you had been in this accident, that, you know, lives were lost and that you were going to be going to trial, what was going on in your own mind?
I kind of shut down and it was, I mean, I was in shock, I think. They ended up taking me to put me in intake, and I had my phone call with my parents after they issued me, you know, the uniform and everything and took all my clothes for evidence. And I just, I mean, I've never heard my parents the way that I heard them that night. And I remember my mom just, she just said, how are you doing? And I said, not good. She said, well, we love you. I mean, in a conversation like that, there's not much to say other than to show support, I think. I'm not sure what else they could say. So next morning I wake up and I remember I was just bawling. I was just crying and crying. And the staff member was like, what are you crying about? I mean, you did what you did and that's why you're here. And I said, well, just look at my chart. Look at my record. And they opened the manila folder that had my information in it, and they just said, oh my God, and the staff started crying, and I mean, it was just one of the worst moments of realization how serious, I mean, it was just the morning after, you know, and just one of the many moments that we've had to understand how serious this really is.
And when you heard that Chris publicly forgave you, what was that moment like for you?
It was incredible. I mean, it was the next day. It was the day after the accident, and my parents had heard it through a couple of their friends. And when my mom said that, we just kind of, you know, my dad, mom, and I just kind of broke down and just hugged each other. And just, I don't think any of us can understand, and I don't think anybody can understand of things. I don't think they can understand what this kind of forgiveness would be. And it's just, I mean, it's unfathomable. This is not a normal thing for a human being to be, you know, to be saying, you know, and it's pretty emotional to hear that, because he's one in a billion on this earth. You don't hear that from very many people on this earth, and I mean, he's just a huge blessing in my life, and has really given me more than anybody ever will give me in my life.
We're going to take a quick break. But before we do, this series is produced by Headspace Studios. Headspace has thousands of hours of meditation, mindfulness, movement, and sleep content. The best tool you have is your mind, so take care of it. Learn more at headspace.com. How quickly after that did you have any interaction with Chris?
Very first time I had an actual interaction with Chris was during trial, and I was sitting at my, you know, at the defense table, and I looked back. Chris was in the congregation, and I looked and I made eye contact with him. And I just mouthed to him. I said, "I'm sorry." And that was, I mean, he kind of, you know, nodded and you know, gave me a look of, you know, a positive look, I should say. I don't know how to explain that, but it wasn't a negative, you know, hate-filled look, which was just incredible, because that's definitely what I was expecting.
Cameron was charged with 4 counts of automobile homicide and tried as a juvenile since he was still 17. He spent 30 months in juvenile detention at the Wasatch Youth Center. While there, he underwent intensive therapy. One day, his therapist suggested he and Chris meet in person. Can you take me back to that? Because I imagine that to be an incredibly emotional and raw experience.
I mean, how do you face somebody that, I mean, you did this to, and somebody that is able to forgive you after that? Just super intimidating and really hard to think about. Chris was eager. I guess eager probably isn't the right word to use, but he wanted to meet with me and talk to me, you know, and help me any way that he can. At that point, I had been so far down my, therapy and everything, that I had made an internal change, and I was willing to do whatever it took. But I remember him walking in, and there was a just kind of, it was a positive feel when he walked through the door, and he smiled at me. He shook my hand, and I basically said, "How are you doing?" And so one of the things that we talked about was his family, Michelle, and Anna and Ben, and understanding what kind of people they were.
When I heard it was a 17-year-old boy that had struck our car, I knew that he was going to have a burden that he was going to carry for the rest of his life, that he had been handed a life sentence in that. And so I think that helped me to kind of not focus so much on wanting justice or pain or retribution. I already had a sense from my own experience that he was going to carry this for the rest of his life.
I had a whole list of questions that my therapist and I had kind of written out. It wasn't even on my paper. I put my paper down and I just said, how can you do this? How can you sit down and you know, talk to me about this stuff? And how can you even forgive me in the first place?
I've looked back into my life and asking that question, you know, what was it that got me to the point where I could at least be open to a suggestion to let it go? And so I've looked at specific stories in my life that I think have become, for me, preparatory experiences that have helped me to get to that point. One, for example, I was a 16-year-old high school, typical high schooler. As soon as I got my license, I got a chance to work as an orderly in the hospital. Just going to work one day, I'm going about 20, and as I mentioned, trying to find a place to park, that two little boys who were running around their front yard ran in between two parked cars and right into the path of my car. As a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, the 4-year-old was the first one through the two parked cars. I didn't see him. He hit the side of my car, but not only did I strike him, but he got lodged in the wheel well of my car. I didn't know that until as I was sitting by myself in the police car, a policeman told me of that they were trying to get him out. I thought the 3-year-old boy was the one that maybe had hit the car and bounced off and was okay. I was able to see him after I had applied the brakes and ran out to him to see if he was okay, but had no idea that there was a 4-year-old boy that I had struck. 2 days later, when my father informed me that the boy passed away, that was a significant trial in my life. You know, I didn't see a path forward immediately from causing... being the one driving, even though it was a complete accident. I wasn't under the influence of anything. I wasn't speeding. I was trying to be responsible. And then this just happens.
Back in the detention center, when Cameron asked how Chris was able to forgive him in the first place.
And he, I'm going to get religious here. But he just said, it's not me. It's Christ that I'm doing this through. It's just a reflection of Christ going through me.
I think what did occur in the car is that, you know, all of those life experiences, all of those little choices that I made over a period of many, many years to try and be better, to try and be more loving, to let it go, as imperfect as I was at, you know, all those prior experiences, and trust me, I was very imperfect and not very forgiving, they all kind of came to that moment.
One of the questions I get asked the most about forgiveness is people wanting to know whether it's a one-and-done thing. You choose to forgive once and you move on. Chris's story seems to embody this when he first made the choice to forgive the night of the accident. But remember, forgiveness is a practice. You may be able to do it and mean it one moment, but there's no promise that you're really finished.
At least for me, my experience is forgiveness was not one-and-done. It's been like a million and continuing. There's always that temptation to go back and to say, you know, why did I do that? Why did I let it go? Why did I not be more, angry and to direct that and demand justice? But in the moment when you're feeling angry, it feels so justifiable. It feels like, you know, it feels so right. And yet it's not. If I was unforgiving or angry, I mean, who would I be angry at now? I mean, Cameron he's moved on. He's got his beautiful family and he's successful and doing just an amazing things and growing and things. I'm so proud of that. And, you know, if I were still trying to hold on to something, you know, some injustice that had happened and trying to pin it on somebody, I mean, that somebody doesn't even exist anymore.
I'm curious as to what, when you feel those moments of anger or, you know, frustration or how could I possibly have forgiven, what are the tools that you use to bring yourself back to living in a place of forgiveness?
Fantastic question. So a couple of things have been very helpful. I started to practice and develop a mindset of focusing on those things that I could control and letting go of the things that I couldn't control, letting go of the frustrations and pain and identifying those triggers, identifying those thoughts, and then countering them with pre-decided, pre-practiced thoughts to cut them off, to help me not go down those destructive paths where I'll feel good and then I'll get the thought and I've just got to cut it off and I've got to come back and then I get the thought again, I got to cut it off. But I found that over time, I have been, and with practice, it's easier for me and it's quicker for me now to cut those thoughts off. And I have found that I can now go through months and weeks and not even have that kind of a thought. Whereas initially, right after, and especially in the months following, it was minute to minute sometimes.
This process he's describing is called noting. It's a mindfulness technique. It's about becoming aware of a thought before we react to it, feed it, or act on it.
I'm not perfect. I didn't, wake up that morning with this perfected ability to be forgiving. It's not just one of those things that we can just innately say, oh, we're good people, and it'll just naturally come to us. I don't believe that. I think it is something you have to practice.
Chris doesn't try to suppress his feelings when he has trigger moments or days when he feels sadness, anger, or heartbreak. He allows himself to feel the feelings when they naturally come up, embrace them, and then work his way back to a place of forgiveness.
Their passing has left a hole that can never be filled in my heart, and it's a hole that I grieve to and for today. It's very difficult sometimes to think of them. I want to be with them, and there's still pain that has never gone away, and I don't expect it ever will. I've been handed, I think, a life sentence as well. So it begs the question, what do I do then with that pain?
While Chris was able to forgive in the moment of the accident, it took Cameron a little longer to figure out his journey with forgiveness.
It's just crazy difficult to forgive yourself. But where I had total control of this, and I caused this by, a decision that I made, it's incredibly difficult. It's not like there's just this one moment where you're like, okay, I've forgiven myself, I'm done, I'll never think about it again. It's an ongoing process. I do believe that I have forgiven myself. Where Chris has been able to do that as well, it has given me an immense amount of strength to be able to continue and believe in myself that, I am a good person, and I can make some great impacts on this world and help other people with the story that we have. But it's definitely an ongoing process and a struggle.
When you have moments where you struggle with forgiveness of yourself, what are your practices to bring yourself back to a place of forgiveness?
I think that one of those things is what we're doing right now. And it's one of service, really. It's my parents have always taught me about service and always help other people. And even that's one of the ways that I got through my time in Wasatch, and that's is to be able to help people. That just somehow, when you're unselfish like that, it somehow has just an incredible feeling, and it helps you get through those moments of sorrow for sure.
Today, the two are friends and have a beautiful and unique relationship. What is it like to be able to speak about this together?
You want to go first, Chris?
Sure. Well, the word that comes to my mind is comfortable. I mean, it's just as we, met outside, it just, we gave each other a big hug. It's, very comfortable. I think for me, it's not about, meeting someone that, 13 years ago from my past, it's meeting a brother that I've been able to forge a relationship with over the last 13 years. So it's very comforting to know that, that I have that kind of a friend in the world, and that I have someone that not only have been able to come to know, but at this point in my life that I love, and so it's very comfortable.
And I feel the same way. It's just an honor to sit next to Chris, because I wouldn't be here today. I can tell you that. I mean, not physically, I wouldn't be here on this earth today.
Yeah, so amazing, and I'm curious as to the definition of forgiveness for each of you. Because I think, as I've learned through writing this book and also talking to so many people, is that everyone has such a different view on forgiveness and what it means to them in their lives. So I would love to hear what forgiveness means to you both. So Chris, why don't we start with you?
For me, it's moving forward. It's preserving the opportunity to grow, to change, and move forward. I'd always thought of forgiveness as something that, you know, that just blessed others, that, you know, it was a selfless act, that you gave forgiveness and that all was healed and all was made better. And what I have realized is that as, through my forgiveness, is that you are the beneficiary of that forgiveness. And I think forgiveness for me is just that. It's defined as choosing that positive path forward.
Yeah, and for me, it's, I think the biggest word that comes to my mind is acceptance, and being able to accept the situation. You know, if somebody is, or if you made a bad decision, you got to accept that, and there's nothing you can do about it. So that the best thing you can do, just like Chris said, is to be able to learn from that mistake that you've made and be able to move on. But I think definitely the biggest thing first is to accept that something has happened and that there's nothing that can be done to change that.
When I set out to tell this story, I wanted to know how Chris was able to do this, how he was able to forgive the person who killed members of his family, and how he was able to start doing it in that very moment right after the crash. I did learn about the practical reasons he was able to forgive, like his own personal experience with a tragic accident, the process of self-forgiveness he'd gone through, his faith, and his belief that people can change. But more importantly, it showed me that forgiveness doesn't just help you, it frees you. Our words and our actions have impact beyond anything we may ever get to see. Chris's forgiveness of Cameron helped Cameron to forgive himself and inspired a community to be a little kinder. Thanks for tuning into this episode. If you want to learn more about Chris and Cameron's story, you can find it in my new book, The Gift of Forgiveness. Next week, I'll be talking with Jessica Simpson about the role of forgiveness in her life. We also discuss her journey with getting sober and practicing self-forgiveness. The Gift of Forgiveness is hosted and executive produced by me, Catherine Schwarzenegger Pratt. You can find my book, also called The Gift of Forgiveness, wherever books are sold. This show is produced by Monique Laborde, sound design by Dan Kroll. From Headspace Studios, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland, Morgan Selzer, and Sam Rogaway. This podcast is produced in partnership with Cadence 13.